From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour will be made on Election Day when New York voters decide whether to re-elect Governor Andrew Cuomo. We've invited Governor Andrew Cuomo numerous times to join us. We hope that eventually he will. Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino is challenging the governor, and he joins us live right now. Rob, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Evan, thank you.
Hey, by now it's well documented that Governor Chris Christie and the Republican Governors Association in many ways has left your candidacy stranded. Senator Dean Skelos has said he supports you, but we haven't seen a whole lot to show it. Do you get the sense at this point, about a month to Election Day, has your own party failed you, Rob?
Oh, I think Republicans of all stripes in New York are following and helping us. Quite frankly, I don't really care where some of the endorsements come from, if they come from at all, because as I outlined in a real long speech this morning, well, 30 minutes, but in a speech this morning at the Association for Better New York in New York City, this is about, my campaign is about reforming this state. And some noses are going to get out of joint because we have got to clean up the corruption. We have got to break the status quo. And I talked about, I don't know if you've seen the, you know, what's going on, the documentaries about the Roosevelts on TV.
Yep.
And it's great. And, you know, you talk about Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, fifth cousins. Politically, they were opposite, but they actually supported each other because they both stood for cleaning up the corruption, breaking the status quo, not accepting the unacceptable. And they went against the party bosses, and they weren't afraid to do that because they were in it for the right reasons. So I am on this campaign now in the last 34 days to fix this state no matter what it takes. And the corruption out of Albany is reaching new levels every day. Another indictment today for a Queens Assemblyman. How many more do we have to accept? And unfortunately, corruption has become the accepted order of business in Albany. And it should not and cannot be that way because this corruption is coloring every decision made now in Albany, especially by the governor. The governor is under federal investigation for the Moreland Commission scandal. He's being investigated for potential crimes like obstruction of justice, witness tampering, from the U.S. attorney. And this is serious. And the last thing we should do is accept this as the status quo, as just the way business is done. Because what happens is the privileged few who write $25,000 and $50,000 checks to this governor, who have access, they're doing great because they're getting the winks and the nods, they're getting the tax credits, the contracts. The rest of us are not doing so good in this state. We're getting left behind, and we're paying for that corruption in like a corruption tax. That's why taxes are so outrageously high in New York State. That's why people are fleeing this state. The economy is so bad. You know, the fact that the poverty rates with children are highest in the nation in Rochester and Buffalo, and we're not talking about it in this race, is despicable. About the economy, which is so terrible, Rochester and Buffalo and Syracuse and other cities in New York rank at the bottom 20 in America with the worst economic outlook going forward. These are issues that are vitally important to people, whether you're a farmer, whether you're a small business owner, whether you're a corporation trying to stay here and hire more people. We're not talking about it. The governor doesn't want to talk about this because he's under federal investigation. I'm talking about it. And whether it's, you know, talking about the corruption in Albany and how it has to end, or as I mentioned today, lowering taxes in the state. If we're dead last in America, highest taxes in the country, then we have got to start marching in a different direction. Otherwise, we're going to stay stuck in 50th place in America, and that's unacceptable.
No. I should
last
also say,
night,
Rob,
well, Evan, last night,
go ahead.
I had Governor Rick Perry from Texas was with me in Long Island and in Buffalo. Governor Scott Walker was with us a month ago. Governor Jindal from Louisiana is coming in 2 weeks. Carly Fiorina, who leads Democrats for Astorino, one of the most respected businesswomen in America. So we're getting support, and I'm grateful for that support. But ultimately, it's not going to be endorsements that matter. It's going to be getting out our vote and people saying enough is enough with this governor.
Now, the governor has said, his campaign staff, I should say, has said that you make the allegation that those who contribute to him are doing great, everybody else is suffering. They're saying, look at Westchester County, the big contributors to your campaigns in the past and to your funds have gotten the contracts, have gotten the work, and that it's essentially pay-for-play there as well. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd love to talk about pay-to-play right now with what's happening in Albany and this governor. This governor has raised millions upon millions in pay-to-play, and they're not even trying to cover it up anymore. That's how blatant the corruption is, how in-your-face it is in Albany. And what you see is a contract is given. The next day, a $25,000 or $50,000 check comes in. A contract or a tax credit is given, same thing, or day before it happens. And that's just what's been going on with this governor, who can unilaterally give these things out. Got to remember, he took away all of the special contracts and, you know, the giveaways that the legislators used to have in Pork Barrel. Now the governor has them, and he's going around the state handing them out like lollipops and giving out the checks. And he just, the latest is $750 million of your money and my money, and giving it back in, quote, tax refund. Well, all it is, and I think everybody realized this, it's just governor's bribe to try to get voters to pull the lever for him, you know, with their own money. That's not tax policy. That's not economic policy. That's the gimmicks that keep us dead last in the country. And in Westchester, we have what's called a pre-qualification board, separate independent body that looks at the qualifications of people bidding. Then it has to go, on their recommendation, it goes to the Board of Acquisition and Contract, which is a powerful board, which in the past was basically held in secret. The county executive, the DPW commissioner, and the Board of Legislators chairman, a Democrat, can vote on these contracts. And almost all of them are unanimous, which means the Democrats on the county board support the contracts that are being given out by this board because they're legitimate, they're low bid, they went through the process. I don't get to hand out contracts like lollipops. This governor does. And that's what we have in Westchester, the safeguards, to make sure there's no pay-to-play. That's not what they have in New York State, which is what the governor is feeding off of.
Okay, and so again, those 236 contracts worth more than $700 million to nearly 50 companies since you took office, those companies contributing nearly $1 million to your fund, what you're saying is that is essentially coincidental and that those are the companies with the best bids that it's been vetted.
Well, that's the fact because, again, there's a Democrat that sits on the three-member panel. He's the chairman of the Board of Legislators. So he would have every right and would politically come after me if this was the case. If we were handing out contracts that were not qualified, that these companies were not qualified for, that the work was not needed, that's not the case. And if anyone knows the dealings I've had with the Democrats on the county board in Westchester, I mean, they go after me all the time for a lot of nonsense, but we've had a working relationship with a coalition of Democrats on the board to get things done, but they have the complete oversight. In fact, we went way further than anything had ever been done in Westchester for this board. We now tape them and stream them online. We put in advance of the meetings the board agenda, and we also list online so anyone could download it or view it, all the contracts themselves, so people can see them. That's the transparency that I'm talking about that we brought to Westchester that doesn't exist in New York.
All right, now speaking of pay-to-play, Governor Cuomo's team has touted his support for keeping the Buffalo Bills in Buffalo. And yes, it led to some silly ads. But here's a serious question. Sometime in the next 6 years, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says the Bills will need to build a new stadium to keep the team here. We've done the math. The last five NFL stadiums cost an average of $900 million with varying levels of taxpayer subsidy. How much should New York taxpayers be willing to contribute to that total for the Bills?
Maybe nothing, because you know, Mr. Pegula, who owns the team, is a very wealthy man. He's a good businessman. I'm glad he got it, by the way. I'm glad he won the Buffalo Bills and now owns them. In 6 years, I have no idea what the economic condition of New York is going to be. But the Bills are very, very important to Western New York. We want to make sure they stay here. I think with Terry Pegula, he has stated that they will stay here. There have already been state and county upgrades to Ralph Wilson Stadium. And Do I think a new stadium is needed? Probably not. If it's going to be done, then I think Terry Pegula should pay for that. And if it's done in downtown Buffalo, I think it would be a great idea. But I think it's certainly premature to see if something is needed, but I would be inclined to not use taxpayer dollars for that.
We've got some questions from listeners online who say they like what they're hearing from you when it comes to corruption, to cleaning up Albany. They have questions about the social agenda. And so regarding the women's equality agenda, it's no secret that the sticking point has been the 10th point, which would codify abortion law in New York State. Rob, you've said that abortion isn't going anywhere in New York State, so you don't think that point is necessary. Last year, 23 states narrowed access in some form to abortion. So let me ask you a kind of a separate question. Regardless of where New York State has always been politically or where it is now, if you had your way, would you restrict or eliminate abortion access in this state?
Look, I'm pro-life. I've made no bones about it. But this is a state that is 4 years ahead of the curve with regard to abortion rights in New York. It was brought into New York by law 4 years, I think it was, or 3 years before Roe v. Wade. This is used as a boogeyman to gin up support for the Democrats and to try to raise money and to scare people. And quite frankly, to change the topic so we don't talk about the issues that really matter to people, like how are we going to get people back to work? How are we going to bring the poverty level down in Rochester and Buffalo and all of New York City and areas around the state? How is this economy going to turn around? How are we settling for the corruption that needs to be cleaned up in Albany? Because he doesn't want to talk about that. And the taxes that are driving people out, and the 400,000 people, many of whom were pro-choice, who left New York State because they can't afford to live here and there are no more opportunities. That is what we need to be talking about in New York State. Abortion, quite frankly, there's 105 of the 150 assembly members are Democrats, many of which are from New York City. You also have pro-choice Republicans in the Senate. So abortion is not going anywhere, but where it's not going to go is to be increased to allow third trimester abortions up to birth, unequivocal, and performed in some cases by non-doctors. And who do you think are going to have third trimester, very dangerous abortions in this state if permitted? It's going to be the poor who don't have access to good quality health care. It's not the rich person who has a gold-plated health care plan. And so we agree, everyone agrees for the most part, that 9 of the 10 points in that agenda are okay and should be voted upon, including the National Organization of Women and the sponsors of that bill. Andrew Cuomo and a few others are using the 10th point, which is very divisive, to expand abortion into the third trimester up to birth, which would take away language which only had doctors perform it. You take away that language, and then non-doctors can perform it. And that's what they want to focus on so we can have a boogeyman in this race. So I've said, fine, do the 9. Everyone supports that, but they won't allow it.
We're talking to Rob Astorino. He's running for governor against Governor Andrew Cuomo. He's the Westchester County executive, and minimum wage, Rob, continues to be a flashpoint in the state. Zephyr Teachout and Howie Hawkins have called for $15 an hour. I know you've said that's untenable. Governor Cuomo has supported incremental, smaller increases. So let me ask you, should there be a minimum wage, and what should it be?
The minimum wage should be set at the federal level. And what you have now is not incremental. New York City, the mayor of New York City, just signed an executive order going to $13.13. Now, the governor has said, because of his deal with the Working Families Party, which calls for massive new spending, higher taxes, even more regulations, and making it harder for businesses, that's the agenda he signed on to right now in a very public way. To have a $13 or a $15 minimum wage in areas that are so economically depressed right now, that are lagging behind, have a very high unemployment rate, high poverty rate, I don't see how that helps anybody in Rochester, any small business, any business, or certainly our agricultural districts and businesses. This could be the death knell for many parts of the state. You know what the effective minimum rate is in North Dakota? It's about $15 or $20. You know why? Because the unemployment rate is about 2.5%, because the economy is booming, because they're taking advantage of the energy that they have, and they have a whole energy boom in North Dakota. So people are being hired at McDonald's for $15, $18 an hour. Security jobs that are needed are being hired in these kind of ranges. That's what a good economy does. They don't even talk about a minimum wage in North Dakota because things are going so well. Why do we even need to talk about raising the minimum wage in New York? It's because the economy is terrible. It's because people are fleeing here. Businesses are getting crushed and laying off workers. On the same day that Cuomo went to announce that his, quote, Startup New York started up 7 new jobs in Buffalo, Tyson Foods announced they were closing their plant and 300 people were losing their jobs. So, you know, there's the Andrew Cuomo world that doesn't exist because he thinks things are going great in New York. And then there's all the people I've talked to in every 62 counties, all the 62 counties in New York, as I heard it in their voice and saw it in their eyes, people are discouraged. They're losing jobs. They're worried about their next paycheck. And unless we change the policies that are destroying the economy and holding it down, we're never going to get the state back on its feet. And the only way you change the policies is to change governors.
Rob, you've talked about fracking, and you mentioned energy in the Dakotas for an example here. Well, now in New York State, there's been a judicial ruling on the concept of home rule, and that means that local municipalities can decide to enact bans that are going to be protected when it comes to hydrofracking. So Governor Cuomo's put off a decision on this, and I think that's well documented by now. He's not going to make a decision for the election. But now, if you're elected governor, you would have to deal with home rule anyway. So what would your approach to fracking be in the midst of this new legal environment?
Nothing changes, because there are many communities and counties that want to move forward with natural gas exploration, and they should be allowed to do that. But they can't do it unless we set up sensible rules and regulations that protect public health and the water supply in the unlikely event that something would happen. You know, we would set up buffer zones around the Finger Lakes, around the Catskill water supply. But there are a lot of areas where we should be moving forward, and the communities that want to take advantage of this should be allowed to do it. And what I have said is, in the first 90 days, we're going to tell the health department and the DEC, because they've had 6 years already, and look, let's be honest, they know it's fine, they know we should be doing it. It's held back for political reasons by this governor, who is just politically paralyzed, because there's some people on the Upper West Side of Manhattan that want no fracking, and as a result, the governor is listening to them and not listening to the people throughout New York State who are desperate for good jobs, who are desperate for some good income, who are desperate for careers. And we will move forward with this. The EPA, Obama's EPA, President Obama's Energy Department, Interior Department, have come out emphatically and said that natural gas extraction is safe. And our own senators, Schumer and Gillibrand, Democrats, have said we should be moving forward with this. 30 other states are doing it and doing it successfully. Billions in revenue, you know, thousands and thousands of people with good paying jobs, cleaner air, by the way. We already use, Evan, in our state of New York, 35% of our energy consumption is from natural gas. 30% is from nuclear. And yet, those are the two industries that Andrew Cuomo wants to shut down. So how would we grow this economy if the two energy supports, the two energy sources that are needed for manufacturing and for businesses would be not permitted? I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever.
The New York Times writes that in your term as county executive, you've been contemptuous of an order signed by your predecessor in Westchester County to integrate housing. They say you've dragged your feet, and the result is more de facto segregation. Are you concerned about, and I talk about Westchester County, but if you look at Rochester, New York, if you look at Buffalo, there's concern about sort of de facto segregation. Are you concerned about that?
What people in Monroe County and Erie County and Ontario County and every other county in New York should be concerned about is the federal government getting its way in Westchester, because what HUD, Housing and Urban Development, is demanding is that Westchester declare all of our communities with no proof whatsoever, including no proof from the federal government, declare our communities segregated, discriminatory, and as a result have federal bureaucrats in Washington dictate zoning in your local community. And that's what this fight is about. The settlement that was approved by my predecessors, we're fulfilling. No court, despite what Andrew Cuomo's false advertising says, has found us guilty of anything. No court has ruled us in contempt or has said that we're not following the rules. In fact, we are well ahead of schedule in building the 750 units of fair and affordable housing that we're supposed to. And we'll complete the terms of this contract between the county and the federal government. What I'm not going to do, and this is where I draw the line, and this is where the friction is, I am not going to reverse the conclusions by the county, by Pace University separately, and quite frankly, by the federal monitor overseeing this, who unfortunately works for HUD and can be fired by HUD, so it's a little bit of a kangaroo court. But even he came out and said that there were no zoning violations for our communities based on race or ethnicity. It's socioeconomic. Well, yes, that's true. We have high taxes in Westchester, and we do around New York State. So some people can't afford a home, and there are homes I would love to live in that I can't afford in. But that does not mean that everyone doesn't have the same opportunities to buy a house anywhere they choose. And this is so frightening, what the federal government and Andrew Cuomo now believes in, because he has not helped Westchester, and he has basically rooted for his own agency, which is coming to a community near you. Westchester will, and I will, uphold our local rights under home rule, as you just talked about, to plan and zone our own communities as we are guaranteed under the state constitution. The federal government has said there shall be no restrictions, none, no restrictions on height, density, acreage, number of bedrooms in any community. So if you live on a quarter acre piece of property or a half acre piece of property, that's your neighborhood, you should have no restrictions on how high a building can be, how many people can be in a building. This is crazy. And I'm not going to let federal bureaucrats dictate their own social agenda to all of our community, any of our communities. That's what we're fighting. That's the difference. And so I will continue to not yield on that.
All right, one quick phone call. This is John in Rochester. John, you're on with Rob Astorino. Go ahead.
Hey, Rob. You know, it's ironic. Governor Cuomo takes credit in part for the purchase of the Buffalo Bills and keeping the Bills in Buffalo. Yet it's ironic that Terry Pegula made his money in hydrofracking.
Yeah,
and these opportunities could be put to other people in this state. Who knows what economic vitality could come about?
Well, I do know, and I think the 30 other states know what the economic activity would be from natural gas. By the way, we're already fracking in New York and have been for decades and decades. It's not horizontal, it's vertical fracking.
And there is a big difference.
There is a difference, but the science is, according to the National Academy of Sciences, it is safe. And just because some filmmaker decides to put out images that have nothing to do with fracking and are emotional, I mean, who the heck would want a child to drink, you know, poisonous water? Nobody. Not anyone who's normal and loving, of course not. But it does not mean that the science has not been settled on this. We need to move forward in a reasonable way. That's it. Find the balance between safeguarding the environment, but moving forward. And that's what we need to do in this state, and that's what I will do.
We only got a couple more minutes. I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more quick questions. Rob, the public radio station in New York City has invited you and Governor Cuomo to debate. Governor Cuomo already accepted. Your staff said they accepted before you even saw the email, and they should have consulted with you on the details. Are you going to do that radio debate?
I'm not sure yet, because I have said to the governor, let's have 8 regional debates. And, of course, nothing. We got 5 invitations. One from ABC in New York, along with the New York Daily News and Univision. One from Time Warner Cable, along with Cablevision for statewide cable. And other legitimate news agencies that had offered debates. We accepted them all. The governor never responded to any of our emails, letters, texts, phone calls to debate the debates, if you will, to have a legitimate discussion on what the terms of the debates were going to be, what we would accept, and the governor then unilaterally sent out a press release on Saturday saying he's agreed to two debates. The first one, we had no knowledge of. It came in late Friday, and all of a sudden Saturday morning the governor accepts, and it's radio only. And look, I'm on radio right now, and my background is radio and TV. I love radio. But radio should be a component of the debate, and there is no reason, this is not 1945, there's no reason that the people should not be able to sit down and watch a debate between the two candidates or listen to it on the car or on a radio if they choose to. But to say it's going to be radio only in New York City is irresponsible by this governor. The second one is PBS in Buffalo with all the candidates, including two candidates, the Libertarian, who are not campaigning, have not raised a dime, they're not doing any media, they're not campaigning. And this is what the governor complained about and called, quote, a disservice to democracy from the 2010 debate when every candidate was on stage and it was, you know, widely panned as a mockery. And yet, that's the reason why Governor Cuomo said he wouldn't debate Zephyr Teachout, which, of course, was nonsense. So, yes, we got a debate. The people of the state need to hear directly from me and this governor on why he's under investigation by federal prosecutors for corruption, why the state is dead last in America on economic recovery and taxes and business climate and worst state to retire in, and why are people are leaving. He's got to answer those questions. And he owes it to the people to even talk about what he would do in a second term, which he has not done. So this race is closing. We've got 34 days to go. People now realize and sense that we can win this and that we will win this race. We had a great rally yesterday in Buffalo. We are going all over the state. And the energy, the passion, is on our side. You saw what happened on the Democratic side when Cuomo was running in a primary, 40%. Of the party faithful voted against him. And they voted against him for the same reasons that others are going to vote against him on November 4th. The corruption, the worst economy, a state in massive decline.
Rob Mastorino is running for governor, and I should let our listeners know we've multiple times we have invited Governor Cuomo to join this program. He has declined so far. We hope that will change. Rob, the last question, and then you're on your way here. School leaders across our area have been asking about Common Core and about the gap elimination adjustment. They want to know what the next governor, I don't know that the governor can do much but talk about Common Core, and there's sort of skepticism that if you're governor, can you actually do anything about it? And then there's the question of, do you believe that the gap elimination adjustment is unjust to schools who say that they have lost a huge amount of funding and they are being forced to raise property taxes?
Yes. I mean, the governor has taken billions away from schools and then blame the schools for raising taxes when they have no choice because they're suffocating under the mandates that are imposed by Albany and given little options or any tools to overcome the loss in state aid. Common Core, you see what's going on in other states. The governors are leading the way. The governors are not only using the bully pulpit, but are proposing and making sure legislatures roll out a Common Core, which is happening, I think, maybe up to 10 states now that are getting out of Common Core. I have said Common Core is a disaster. My wife is a special ed teacher. I'm the product of public schools. My three children go to public schools. I was on a school board. Common Core is a disaster in its implementation. And when we're left with Common Core, we're still left with the federal government making many decisions, bureaucrats guiding education policy in our state. And I think we should get out of Common Core. I think it's been, in many ways, dumbing down our kids and what they're learning, including many experts who have said that. This is a massive, untested experiment that came out of the Bill Gates Foundation, who they even admit it'll be 10 or 15 years to see if we succeeded at this or not. And there was never, ever any field testing on the development on this. So they have no idea what they got into. And I think we got to get out of it, and I think we got to go back to higher standards in New York, but New York-based standards, not one that is one-size-fits-all proposed by national bureaucrats and think that everyone's going to learn and every child is going to learn the same exact things at the same timetable and get to the same results. Sorry, that's not how it happens, especially our kids who are with individual education plans, special needs, average students who sometimes struggle. These are kids who are going to get left behind.
Westchester County Executive Rob Estorino running for governor. And Rob, thank you for your time today, and hope to talk to you again either before or after the election. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Evan. I hope everyone goes to robastorino.com and learns about our job plan, our education plan, our tax plan, our ethics plan. We've been very serious in what we're going to do to this state, and I hope people go and learn more about us.
Very good. Rob Astorino, thank you, and we will talk to, we hope, Governor Cuomo on this program soon. We're going to take a short break now and come right back with more on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, going vegan. What are the benefits? What are the hardest parts? How can you learn to cook a vegan diet? And how many restaurants focus on vegan eaters? We'll explore how our diet impacts our chances for becoming diabetic and what we can do about it. You can join the conversation on Eating Habits next hour on Connections.
Opening this week at the Little, Love is Strange stars Rochester native John Lithgow with Alfred Molina as a loving couple who finally tie the knot after four decades. But when one of them loses his job, the couple must sell their New York apartment and temporarily live with friends and family while they find something affordable. As they struggle with being apart, they also encounter tensions brought on by the age gap with their new roommates. See details for this modern love story at thelittle.org.
Welcome back to Connections. It's always sort of a scrum to get set for the next segment after the shortest break in radio, and we appreciate the interest and the time of Rob Astorino. Again, for our listeners who've been asking, we've asked the governor to come on this program, and we'll bring him to you and that interview to you as soon as they agree to it. So we're going to shift gears, though, now, because there are new U.S. Labor Department regulations and standards that are going to require federal contractors, of which there are nearly 50,000 companies with approximately 200,000 establishments, to set a new target of having 7% of their workforce be comprised of employees with disabilities. There's a call for colleges and universities to do more to adequately prepare students with the disabilities for the workforce, because the current statistics show really they're not prepared or not prepared enough. Today, RIT is being honored as a good example of what a university can do in this arena. The National Organization on Disability has been hosting events today. There was a news conference today in conjunction with an annual career fair, which we'll tell you about in just a moment here. We should also tell you that this part of our program today is part of Move to Include, WXXI working with a number of community partners to promote inclusion for people with disabilities on every level in our community. We'd appreciate it if you could click on the link at WXXI.org/include and take a moment to share your thoughts and ideas. We'd like to hear from you. Move to Include is funded in part by the Golisano Foundation. Here joining us to talk about this issue and what we all can learn from it, Alan Muir. Alan's the founder and executive director of Career Opportunities for Students with Disabilities. Alan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also here, Carol Glazer, the president of the National Organization on Disability. Carol, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And I know you've come from sort of far afield to be here today. So let me first start and ask why RIT in our community? Let me ask Alan. You've been working with RIT today. Why RIT?
Well, RIT has been a longtime partner of Career Opportunities for Students with Disabilities, COSD, and they are one of the major models out there of doing the right way of preparing students, of having the connection between career services and disability services. And they have the special emphasis on deafness, so they bring that part in as well, of having, you know, the specialty type disability, but also they have a lot of other students with other types of disabilities. So they're looking at this in a very holistic manner, and we like that as a means of having as an example for other schools to follow. And that's what our organization is all about, is making sure that we have as many campuses around the country following a lot of their leads, as well as a couple of other schools.
Now, you're honoring RIT because of what they're doing well, but if you look across the country, what are our universities not doing? When you talk about students who are not prepared to enter a workforce, students with disabilities,
yes,
give me a sense for the landscape.
Well, I think there's 1.4 million students that we know of with disabilities on campuses nationwide right now. And there's still a 46% unemployment rate among college graduates with disabilities. So there's the disconnect that's a lot of different areas, but one thing that COSD particularly attacks is making sure that the preparation of the student is at the maximum that we can do. And just making sure that there is that full employment of all resources on campus to assist the student to be as well prepared as possible. And we're working on the supply side to make sure that, you know, folks that are going to be recruited by these great employers who are at RIT today and at other places will be finding the best candidates.
Carol, let me ask you about these new regulations, the U.S. Labor Department regulations. What should employers know? And frankly, what should we all know about the way that part of the landscape is changing?
Well, let's look at history to begin with. And if we think of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as groundbreaking legislation preventing discrimination, in this case of racial and ethnic minorities. And you look at the fact the numbers are on employment with those populations really didn't change until a good 10 years later with the advent of affirmative action. And you can see the ADA in a similar light. 1990, preventing discrimination against people with disabilities. But according to our polls, NOD has been polling using the firm of Harris Interactive since 1986. The employment numbers for people with disabilities have not changed since well before the ADA. So something more had to be done in order to encourage and incentivize employers to hire people with disabilities rather than just simply not discriminate. And last year, the Department of Labor stepped up, played a leadership role, moved into that void, and is now requiring federal contractors to set a goal. It's not a quota. It's not a requirement. It's a workforce goal. But what's important to note is that 7% workforce goal applies to every single job category in every single company that does business with the federal government. And those companies employ 25% of the nation's workforce. So we could, as a country, this could create 600,000 new jobs for people with disabilities in the first year alone if contractors are going to meet the goal.
And I know you've heard the question or the argument that says it's not that the jobs aren't there, it's that you have to have qualified candidates. And what we're hearing is that there are people who could be qualified candidates with either the proper training, better skills coming out of universities, and or frankly, employers willing to hire them. I mean, I'm certainly there are probably employers who might not think that they're discriminating or might just be thinking that I've got to hire what I think is the best worker available and maybe maybe missing candidates who would be qualified.
That's right.
It's all about sourcing and finding the right sources out there of talent. And now with this regulation that you're referring to, it's Section 503, that has been a great incentive for employers to be able to go and look at different sources that they had not considered before and looking for students with disabilities.
So there are so many ways.
Oh, go ahead.
There are so many ways that employers might inadvertently screen out job seekers with disabilities, even though they have the best of intentions. Some of that has to do simply with the way they portray themselves in their job ads, in the media, on their websites. Do they come off as disability-friendly employers? If I'm a person with a disability and I'm looking at that company, I'm going to look on their website to see if I can find people who have disabilities, and that's going to tell me that's a company that's disability-friendly. You can inadvertently screen out job seekers with disabilities in the way that you word your job descriptions and the experience requirements you look for. If you're looking for 10 years of experience in a position and you're looking to a workforce that has historically been not inclusive of people with disabilities, might you not think, well, let's see, can 10 years navigating the streets of New York City in a wheelchair, can that qualify as having some pretty good experience, even though it's not experienced directly in the workforce? So it's everything from how you portray yourself as a company, and does that encourage people to come forward and disclose their disabilities when they have them, all the way to how you might be inadvertently screening people out just by the way you phrase your job descriptions.
We're talking to Alan Muir, the founder and the executive director of Career Opportunities for Students with Disabilities, and Carol Glazer, the president of the National Organization on Disability. Alan, you wanted to weigh in on that last point as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one last point, and again, to bring it back to students and preparation. There are so many different skills, as Carol mentioned, problem-solving skills is the biggest one for people with disabilities. And I think that that's where we are constantly encouraging post-secondary institutions to be, finding the best ways of bringing those skills out of students and being able to have them tell their story about that. Employers need to hear that because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for problem-solving skills. They're looking for a different perspective to different issues that most of the rest of us probably wouldn't have in the same way. So all of that is a big component of making sure that that student will be very much available and ready and competitive.
And how, if there's a gap, or if there's a gap or a perceived gap in problem-solving skills, when it comes to workers or potential workers with disabilities, how do you deal with, how do you correct that, how do you train for that and educate for that?
Well, it's really their own innate problem-solving skills, just from being able to, as Carol mentioned, just to navigate, you know, in everyday life. For me, I'm a person of very short stature, and so I make decisions every day about how I'm going to get into things or get into buildings, get into places. And so those decisions are very calculated, but I don't think about them because they've become second nature to me. Other folks with disabilities have the same idea. So if you help them break that down and then show that to employers, they're going to be like, okay, I can use that skill. That's something I really need from you that's going to help my workplace.
We also want to mention that if you have a business in the area and would consider hiring a deaf or a hard of hearing student for either a 10-week co-op or for permanent employment, RIT has the National RIT's National Technical Institute of the Deaf, NTID, hosting its own job fair. That's coming up on Wednesday, October 29th at NTID. Wednesday, October 29th at NTID. Students and recent graduates who studied business, computing, engineering, science, visual communications, and liberal arts will be attending. And for more information, you can contact the NTID Center on Employment. That number is 585-475-6219. 585-475-6219. Again, that's coming up on October 29th. Now, Alan and Carol, when it comes to the number of 7%, I don't know if employers think that that is a high mountain to climb. I don't know where the numbers are right now. Is there an average? Is it anywhere close to 7%?
Employers aren't really counting.
Right,
will be required to under the new regulation. But the anecdotal information that we get tells us that employers think they have about 3% of their workforce as people with disabilities. We at NOD believe that number is likely far higher. Mm-hmm. But some of this is simply the fact that people are afraid to disclose. There's a stigma around disability. Mm-hmm. What will my coworkers think? Will people think I'm going to be as productive? Will my boss worry about absenteeism? But employers who have taken those first steps, Evan, you asked about what is it about this whole issue that gives employers pause, and might they worry about problem-solving skills? Those employers who have taken those first steps, and it's not hard to hire people. This isn't really that big of a deal. You do it all the time. Sometimes you do it well. Sometimes you don't. But employers who have taken those first steps and brought people with disabilities, a range of disabilities, into their workforce have, in fact, seen that, just as Alan said, those unique problem-solving skills, navigating a world that isn't built for you, can be trained toward higher productivity in the workforce, less absenteeism, greater loyalty, higher retention rates. So just taking that first step is often all that's needed.
What is the unemployment rate for people with disabilities now, and how does it compare historically?
Only about 20% of all working age Americans with disabilities is currently in the workforce. And that number hasn't really changed much, certainly since before NOD started polling in 1986, 4 years before the ADA.
How could we have nearly 30 years without much progress on this? It's really remarkable.
Well, if you think about the whole history of the way that we as a society have dealt with disability in this country, we still have a very long ways to go. I have a son who is developmentally and physically disabled. Had he been born 20 years before he was born, I would have had to send him away to an institution. That was the accepted mode of dealing with people with developmental disabilities not very, very long ago. So we still have a ways to go as a society in acknowledging that this is a very high, one in five Americans has a disability. That number is going to grow as my generation of baby boomers ages into disability. But as a society, we're going to have to get very smart very quickly.
Is it about simply not, for employers who, again, who may not think that they are discriminating, but they make assumptions about what people are capable of? And Alan, you talked about your own stature. Have people misjudged you over the years?
Oh, yes, they have. And I think it all is based on how comfortable you are with your own skin as to whether...
But that can be tough, right?
It is extremely tough. And that's one of the reasons why we are working so hard to help students really gain that level of confidence. And, you know, we do an event that actually brings together about 60 students and recent grads with disabilities to meet with 11 employers for 2 half-days of networking. And we do this twice a year. And it's a great way for employers and for students to really get to be comfortable with one another.
Again, if you want to attend an event coming up here, if you've got a business in the area or you know someone who does and you want to learn more, you'd consider hiring a deaf or hard of hearing student for either a 10-week co-op or permanent employment. RIT's National Technical Institute for the Deaf is hosting its own job fair. That's coming up at the end of this month, 4 weeks from today, Wednesday, October 29th at NTID, if you want to check that out. And, you know, are there a lot of opportunities? Are we seeing growing opportunities for businesses and employers to sort of learn more about how this all works?
Mm-hmm. I think so. We're between NOD's work and what we do at COSD, and we're out there and we're constantly pushing the process of how we can get more employers engaged. And that was the part of the event that I was mentioning earlier.
Yeah.
We do those all around the country, and bringing those students together and the employers together, it changes the whole concept. From the time that the student arrives, they're still like the deer in the headlights look. And then by the time they leave, they can't wait to go back to their home university and tell everybody who they met that weekend. It's a tremendously life-changing experience for those students.
And speaking of employers, I've got a call from Keith. I know Keith in Farmington is an employer himself, and Keith's on the line. Thanks for calling, Keith.
How you doing? Just a comment and a question. Personally, I hope it never does happen, but you ever see a time where we're going to have obesity as a protected status under ADA? Because if we are, I think we're doomed as a nation. As a comment, I went to a deaf wedding once, and it was very heartwarming because this was a person from North America marrying somebody from South America. So you had sign people from ALS Spanish to English. You had such an eclectic mix of human beings, black people with white people with Asian people, Asian people with Indian people, and
That's
so on
great.
And so forth. But their commonality was their deafness. It was a very, very eclectic, heartwarming event.
Diversity on steroids.
Very sick.
Yeah, absolutely. Keith, thanks for the call. What an interesting image that is.
Yeah.
And, you know, he asked if obesity, I don't know the status of that. Carol, obesity is a status disability? No?
No.
Okay. Let's get some closing thoughts here from Carol and Alan. If people have questions about where resources are, about these new regulations and new sort of standards and the goal of the U.S. Labor Department, or anything else you want them to know, I'll start with you, Carol. Where do you want them to go? What
go
do you want them to know?
NOD.org, and I would remind your listeners that we are here today in Rochester as a call to action to America's universities, because as much as employers have to take steps forward, so do universities in order to be able to help them source candidates. And again, look at what Rochester has done. We've just issued a white paper called Bridging the Gap. It's on our website, NOD.org, and we'd encourage your readers to look at it for some very helpful tips, your listeners,
yep.
That is.
Alan?
Well, I think COSDonline.org is my organization's website, and it really is geared to students and to professionals, to employers and to higher education professionals as well. We have our annual conference that's coming up in Philadelphia on November 20th, and then follow that with a with one of our student events that will be there also. So I think we, you know, and particularly in concert with NOD, I think we'll be a good force to really help both ends, the students and the employers, to get to the goal of what we're talking about today.
Alan Muir from the Career Opportunities for Students with Disabilities. He's the founder and executive director. Alan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Carol Glazer, the president of the National Organization on Disability. Thank you, Carol, for being
here.
Thank you.
And
a reminder to our listeners, this part of the program has been part of Move to Include, WXXI working with a number of community partners to promote inclusion for people with disabilities on every level in our community. We'd appreciate it if you want to join the conversation or share some feedback with us at WXXI.org/include and take a moment to share your thoughts and ideas. We'd love to hear from you. Move to Include is funded in part by the Golisano Foundation. I'm Evan Dawson. Short break, and next hour we're looking at the way what we eat impacts our health, diabetes, how we feel. We're talking about the vegan lifestyle next hour. Stay with us.